Di, Viv and Rose would have never crossed paths if they hadn't shared a flat all those years ago at university. Di and Viv and Rose is a new play from UK playwright Amelia Bullmore, and it tells the story of three female friends over the course of nearly three decades. A key aspect of this production is its music. I'm joined today by Kelly Ryle, the composer and sound designer of Di and Viv and Rose. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Kelly, you've worked on many MTC productions over the years, including Joanna Murray Smith's Three Little Words earlier this year.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, when did your relationship with MTC begin?
Well, it began a long, long time ago when there was a program run by Kate Cherry, who I think was a associate at the time. It was called the Wings Project, and it was basically finding young directors to bring in a work that would be a development. And we did a version of The Master and Margarita, and it was just a development, and it didn't go anywhere other than that. But it was the first time I sort of officially set foot inside the rehearsal rooms. From there, it was actually then quite a while until I actually professionally worked with MTC. It was a show called Savage River that was a co-production with Griffin Theatre Company in Sydney, and directed by Peter Evans, who was the associate here at the time when Simon Phillips was AD. And we actually rehearsed it in Sydney but brought it back to Melbourne after its Griffin season to the Lawler, and we were the first theatre outing in the Lawler. So then my next show that I did straight away after that with Peter Evans was God of Carnage, which was a very big playhouse show with Hugo Weaving and Pamela Rabe, and we still rehearsed down in the old Ferrars Street rehearsal space for that. Yeah, so I've had a long association over the years.
Well, it's great to have you working on Di and Viv and Rose, the Australian premiere of this production.
Yeah.
Marion Potts is directing. Have you worked with Marion before?
No, I haven't, but I have a long association with the Malthouse as well, so I've known her through when she was artistic director at the Malthouse. And so we've had plenty of conversations over the years, but we hadn't worked together until this time, so yeah.
And it's a really interesting script, multi-layered, many, many themes. When did you first come across the script?
Well, I get given the script when I get asked whether I'm interested in doing the work. Depending on the show and depending on the director, and this is kind of giving away a bit of inside information here, but sometimes I don't read scripts straight away because I kind of feel that the information that I want that lends itself to music in a piece of work is often from a director and a designer, because they're the ones who are influencing the world that we're then going to make, especially when it's a new work. So certainly with Three Little Words, it's just a script on the page. It'd never been presented before. So it was very much up to Sarah and Michael Hankin and all of us really to kind of dictate what the world was going to be. And it wasn't necessarily related to how scripts or how scenes work. And in that situation, because there was a revolve in it, that became our main focus of how the mechanics of the work was going to work. So with this play, again, when I sat down with Marion and she described to me what her and Dale had come up with in terms of the way that they were going to segue between scenes, which is very, very specific, that is kind of my first way into the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that it's an 80s, that it's partly set in the 80s and that it needs to have a dose of some form of nostalgia in order for that to be broken later on in the work.
Sure. The play begins in 1983.
Yeah.
And over the course of 2 hours, we span nearly three decades.
Yeah, we end up in, I think, 2010 is the last era that we're in the play.
So, I mean, every department, costuming, wardrobe, wigs, makeup,
yep,
this will all be reflected. How will you treat that sonically?
Well, I think it's sort of in the play itself has stage directions that one of the characters plays a cassette in the early stages of the play that then moves into scene changes. And I think the writer ultimately is, which then stops further through the play. So I think the writer is ultimately kind of showing us that she wants that first third of the play to be sort of saturated in 80s sounds and music and so on and so forth. And then as we and the characters get older, that nostalgia gets pushed further and further away. Ultimately, with the goal of allowing us to feel that the characters are also distanced from their, you know, rose-coloured past. And so, that's what we'll be doing with the music as well. Like, it'll be about seeding the notion of the 80s through real tracks earlier on in the piece, which will then sort of slide into more of my score, which will obviously take many nods from the 80s as well. We sort of started with, like you do with an 80s grab bag, of going to all of the pop tracks from that era, but realistically it's one character who plays the music, and her character traits don't necessarily lend themselves to the popular music of the 80s. So we've been going down more the the more student radio station stuff, more of the kind of punkier edge of things, from sort of The Cure to The Clash to Eurythmics to even The Buzzcocks and The Damned and all that sort of stuff that was much more university music of that era.
So steering away from Michael Jackson's Thriller. Yeah,
yeah. As much as I love all of that stuff, it's and that would have been played on radios, but because I grew up, I didn't go to uni in the 80s, but I grew up through the 80s, and so I spent a lot of time at universities in the 80s, and there was that sort of the top 40 hits didn't have a place mostly in those, on jukeboxes or however they were played, or parties that people would have in group houses. People mostly steered away from that top 40 stuff.
Sure.
So it's about trying to find, and also still to give the audience a sense that they are hearing something that's very specifically 80s and something that they might remember. So it's like finding early REM tracks that were before they made it onto commercial radio that would have been played on college radio stations, and it's trying to kind of mine the right character out of the music.
So fun.
Yeah,
you just get to sit down and listen to music.
I do.
Can you tell us a little bit more about, without any spoilers, can you tell us a little bit about some of the sounds? Are there any odd effects, or not so much musical composition, but sound effects in this work?
There are. I mean, I'm because I come to theatre from a composer's perspective, I always try and find a way of using as little sound effects as possible, unless they're actually in a room, like an actual phone ring or an actual doorbell or a door slam or a smash bottle, which all of those we have in this play. I believe that we're making theatre, not film. So if we're in a situation where the script calls for you being beside the coast or beside a busy highway, I no one in the audience believes we're in a film. No one believes there's a highway behind the set. So my perspective is always to try and work a way of making a musical version of that, or sort of abstracting scene directions or special effects kind of cues that are put into scripts, because I think it enhances the theatrical experience.
Dale Ferguson is the costume and set designer for Diane Viv and Rose. And you were saying with Michael Hankins' design on Three Little Words, that informs much of your creative approach. Mm-hmm. How important are collaborations in your line of work?
They're integral, really. Like, it's the difference between a good show and a bad show will be about the depth of collaboration. And sometimes there's a tradition involved in theatre that the designer and the director ultimately make the show, and then sound and lights comes in secondarily to kind of... I don't believe that's the best way to make a show. I think the best way to make a show is to have everyone in the room when the first ideas are brought forward, because music and sound can influence set, can influence lights, and vice versa, and writing can influence all of us, and directors, you know, it's should be one big melting pot, because I think then in the end what we do as creatives are able to be very integrated into a work, whereas sometimes I come along and I'm presented with a massive moving set, and then I have to just deal with it as a problem rather than as a, you know, as an expression.
Technology has majorly influenced your industry, especially in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And you spoke about growing up in the 80s, you know, the transition from cassette to CD. And I mean, CDs are retro now.
Yeah.
How much of your composition are you doing on a computer?
All of it. Yeah. And that, I was sort of late to computers for some reason. Like, I'd never had one around the house. So it was, which a lot of people did like a lot of, depending on, you know, what your parents did for a living would depend on whether there was a computer in the house. And so I didn't, I came quite late to computers. So I mean, I write on instruments, always on instruments. I guess these days I write probably more on a keyboard interacting with a computer than directly on a piano, but still, I would still be able to get melodic ideas or harmonic or rhythmic ideas out on a piano or on a guitar. And then from there, I guess, you know, I mean, the sky's the limit with computers these days. Like, I can have a whole orchestra on my laptop.
Well, can you tell me, what are you most looking forward to about the production of Die and Viv and Rose?
I think the cast are great, and I've worked with Belinda and Mandy many times before, and it feels good in the room. Like, it feels like we're all on the same page, which, you know, some shows it takes you a little while to get to that point where it feels like all of our decisions are heading in the same direction. And I'm pretty excited about exploring the score aspects, which is what I'm sort of doing at the moment. We've sort of pegged all of the popular music that we're going to try for. Whether we get the rights for it is another story. And so now I'm, yeah, very excited about testing the waters with score and how that will work and how that works with the mechanics of the piece, which is partly to do with the set, partly to do with how the writer decides to end the scene, whether they're soft cuts or hard cuts in the story, and so on and so forth. So I'm always excited about finding the ways that, and because the characters are listening to music as well, I love, it's always very, very rewarding watching them perceive or interact with music, even if it's not my own. I love it. Like, having a dance sequence in a piece of theatre is always great.
Yeah. Well, music is very important in this play, and yeah, we are all looking forward to hearing what you come up with.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Die and Viv and Rose, directed by Marion Potts, will play at the Sumner Theatre from the 12th of August to the 16th of September. You can buy tickets online at mtc.com.au or call the box office on 03 86 88 0800. For more talks with interesting designers, directors, actors and theatre makers, go on our blog, mtc.com.au/backstage, or search MTC Talks on SoundCloud or in the iTunes store.